From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Over the years, there have been many happy nights when we've taken a step back from the news and turned our ears and our hearts to some of the best musicians out there. Their songs and their personal stories bring the world to life and into focus in a way that sometimes only music can. We'll go on bringing music and musicians to you, but tonight and tomorrow, in a special two-part summer series, we're listening back to some of the most interesting popular musicians who have performed for the On Point studio. Tomorrow, we'll hear from some rock and roll greats, including Lou Reed, John Mellencamp, and Los Lobos. But tonight, we're sitting down again with some of contemporary music's incomparable women: Cassandra Wilson, Michelle Schacht, Laurie McKenna, Laura Cantrell, and K.D. Lang. Up first, Laurie McKenna. The young singer-songwriter has a celebrated sound that blends the sincerity of Nancy Griffith, the heart of Lucinda Williams, and the raw power of Alanis Morissette, and she's got the music world's attention. Recently, she wrote three songs, including the title track for country superstar Faith Hill's latest album, Fireflies, out just this week. Laurie McKenna brought her guitar to the On Point studio back in 2002, just after the release of her album Pieces of Me. We kicked off our conversation with a live performance. Here's Laurie McKenna singing Mars.
Well, there's a hole wearing through this couch of mine, and all of the cushions are falling out one little piece at a time. You might see yourself in me, but I don't. I see Mars
Welcome, and awfully good to have you, Lori McKenna.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Hey, you're not blonde anymore. You're brunette. I'm looking at two CD covers. What's natural? Where's the real Lori McKenna?
I know. It's always changing.
Lori McKenna, you write music and sing it in a way that's so grown up, and I've jumped in talking about your four kids because it's not what we associate with singers and songwriters, and yet you embrace it and make it the heart of an awful lot of your music. We just heard a cut, Mars, from your latest CD, Pieces of Me. And what parent wouldn't know what this is all about? I mean, I just love you. You've got this country sound, but you're talking first about a hole wearing through this couch of mine. All the cushions are falling out, and then there's a hole wearing in your heart. How did you end up as a singer-songwriter with four kids at the same time?
At the same time? Well, it kind of did happen at the same time, as a matter of fact. You know, I always wrote songs to keep myself busy and to, you know, just that was my outlet, was always writing things down and playing my guitar since I was around 12 or 13. Mm-hmm. And I had my kids young, and I had no intention of ever leaving my house with my songs until I got to be around 27, and I decided that I would give it a shot. You know, I just, you know, it's kind of took that long to get to the point where I was comfortable leaving my kitchen and going out to open mics and things like that, and it just took a life of its own. And has become an enormous part of my life now.
And people respond to it like crazy, obviously, even though this is not teeny bopper love. This is a different realm of love, a different period,
yeah.
The love that parents give to children. Do you find that you're alone in writing about that? Do you have many songwriters that you can reference who have so much of that? The issues of family and parenthood and sacrifice and hope, at the same time you're realizing your own limitations in their songs.
Well, I think that it's all about love. It's just like you say, it's maybe a different perspective of it. And I do meet people that have kids and do this, and you know, it comes from the same place. But I think that part of it is, you know, I got married when I was 19, so
yeah.
I had my kids really young, and I think that for most people nowadays, they experience the love life of a relationship,
mm-hmm.
A lot longer before they get to the kids.
And they experience it when they're in that young, passion-filled time of life.
Right, right. And I think that just for me, that all came. I met my husband in elementary school. You know, we went to school together.
You guys got going.
And you know, we got married really young, and so it. It's funny because in my life I'm really slow at some things and I do other things really productively. So,
well, you're a productive songwriter and you're a productive childbearer. I can't believe that you've got what your children are, but they're all in the young phase. They're all between pretty young and just entering teenage years. So
right. You're
really right in the thick of that.
Yeah.
This wonderful sense in your music of surrendering dreams and fighting surrender,
yeah,
all at the same
definitely,
time.
Definitely, definitely. Because I think that's what it's all about, is picking and choosing, but not letting it go. You can't let it go, you know?
Yeah.
I really think that's important, and I don't think I could ever let my passions for certain things go, or I just wouldn't be the same person if I didn't have my guitar and didn't have this outlet that, you know, that I'm so lucky to have.
Mm-hmm. But you picked that guitar up and went to the open mic when there must have been plenty of Pampers all around the house. Where did you find the ambition, the clarity of purpose to stand up out of that and say, hey, I'm going to take this out to the open mic and get going?
Well, maybe that's what I needed in order to, you know, maybe I needed the kids to... you know, a lot of people, when they have young children, a lot of mothers, I've heard other mothers, you know, tell the story, is that you can lose yourself in that. And you can also lose yourself in music. And I think that since I've been doing this, it's been about 5 years since I've been doing this out of my house, I've been trying to find the balance between both and, you know, not lose myself as a singer-songwriter and that's it, but also not lose myself as just a mother. I'm still Laurie, and I'm still a person, and I think that it's easy to get lost in motherhood, and You don't really find yourself until you're home alone again and the kids are in college. So I've kind of like just kept that in the back of my mind that I don't want to become somebody else for 18 years and then have to refine myself.
Who's smarter than me? Can't sit still and see things differently.
Lori McKenna singing Hardly Speaking a Word from her album Paper Wings and Halo. She spoke with us in 2002. For more information on Lori McKenna's latest album, Bitter Town, go to our website, onpointradio.org. There's much more in this special edition of On Point. After the break, Cassandra Wilson, Michelle Schacht, Laura Cantrell, and K.D. Lang. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I should be yelling, I love you. But I'm hardly speaking a word.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight and tomorrow, we're bringing you a special edition of On Point. We're listening back to some of our favorite musicians who stopped by the studio. Tomorrow night, we'll hear from some rock and roll legends. Tonight, we've tuned in to the bold and beautiful voices of some of contemporary music's most remarkable women. Critics have put our next guest in the lineage of some of the strongest black women blues singers there are, right out there with Bessie Smith, Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday. But Cassandra Wilson has never been content to roll with the status quo. In 2002, she went back to her home state of Mississippi and converted an old train depot into a recording studio. Out of the heat, humidity, and long nights in the Delta came her album, Belly of the Sun, an innovative piece of blues fusion that melded elemental guitar and percussion with the tip of the hat to the likes of Bob Dylan and Robert Johnson. We caught up with Cassandra Wilson after the release of Belly of the Sun. I asked her how it felt to go back to her home state to record the album.
Oh, it was wonderful. There's something that's very special about being in Mississippi. There's something very special about playing music in Mississippi. I think I had forgotten that or something, but I really enjoyed going back and hanging out with a few of my friends and making music.
You made this album in the fabled Clarksdale, where so many blues legends were born, and in a train station that you turned into a studio. How did you do it?
Well, very carefully. We were allowed the opportunity to take over the Clarksdale train depot, what was formerly the Clarksdale train depot, for 5 days. And it had been converted into a community center, and they also used it as a performance space for, you know, pieces of blues festivals that they have there. So we brought in a truck, a mobile recording truck from Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and ran a snake through to the facility and set up microphones. And we didn't have any baffling or anything. We just kind of made do. Danny Copelson, the engineer, did an incredible job changing the space into a recording space.
And this was just last August, so you must have had some hot times recording in Clarksdale.
Oh, yeah. It was it was extreme. Extreme
sure
heat.
As a kid, my family used to pile in the old jalopy every spring and drive down to the Gulf right through Mississippi, down Route 61. And I remember going through this whole area. And their red clay and cotton fields. I was in Greenville not long ago, drove down from Memphis, and it came back again. There really is something just in the air, in the quality of the air, in the vegetation. What is it? What does it breathe down there that made this the birthplace of the blues?
I don't know. That's a great question. I read somewhere once that the Delta used to be the bottom of the ocean in prehistoric times, and that's why it's so fertile. I don't know.
Maybe it's still giving off some vapors there.
Yeah, there's some depth there.
There sure is. I also know that feeling of going home from the urban east to the middle of the country, to the rural part of the country. Does that put you in a nostalgic mood? What juices does it get going to be back there and singing?
Well, my imagination just goes crazy whenever I'm in Mississippi. There's something about mm-hmm. being there, being in the nighttime especially, because mm-hmm. the night has such a wonderful flavor. It's just, well, there are many flavors in the night, and it's like it's a character. You know, the nighttime is a character in Mississippi.
It sure is.
And it's a thing about nature, you know, that it's the reverence that we have for nature, Mississippians, Southerners, and how much store we place in the signs of nature and living, you know, in according to the signs of nature. Mm.
You grew up in Jackson, a bigger town than Clarksdale, but still, mm-hmm. I guess when you were growing up, was right in the heart of the civil rights struggle.
Yes.
Medgar Evers was mm-hmm. shot not far from your home. Do you have active memories of that struggle?
I do. I was not allowed to go to any of the sit-ins. My father and my brothers went down to the Woolworth sit-in several times, and they did march. But they didn't allow me to go with them. But I do remember them going, and I do remember the night that Medgar Evers was killed. And I just remember the feeling that everybody had in the community. And it was very turbulent times, very difficult times. And as a child, you know, you don't quite understand what's happening, but you know you feel something is wrong.
You describe your friend Rhonda Richmond passing his house the next day and seeing the blood still on the carport.
Yes. Yeah, she described that in great detail.
We've got a cut coming up behind us here, Justice, off your new album, Belly of the Sun. Tell us about the song.
Well, I'd written the song after the last presidential election. Watching too much TV, I was glued to the television mm-hmm. set, as I'm sure all of us were. And I was particularly disturbed by the events in Florida. So that song came from that, and it really worked well with what we were doing in the Delta, because when I went to Clarksdale for the first time, I realized how much like, I'm sure, some parts of Florida Clarksdale is, where people just have, you know, still are living in very impoverished conditions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just the perfect time to really do the song.
I think I'll have some of that. Now wrap it up real nice for me, please. Pass me a slice of opportunity. I'll have that slice of opportunity. I hear it fills you up, makes you shine just like summer buttercups. Summer buttercups. I think I'll have some of that. Wrap it up.
Cassandra Wilson, I think a lot of Americans who don't travel through the South may not really understand what it looks like even today. The wood frame houses that the wind can blow right through, the poverty is still extreme in the part of the country and state where you made this album.
Yes, absolutely. It is very much still. It's very difficult. It's very difficult to see that kind of poverty, to witness it, and to drive away from it and, you know, realize that, wow, I live in America and people are still living like this. It's startling. I guess, you know, the Mississippi Delta and some parts of Appalachia still are very poor.
And for Americans who feel like we've, to some extent, you know, licked part of the race problem, the lines still seem very, very stark in the Delta.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another thing that's fairly obvious.
When you're there.
Yeah, especially when you're there. It is still very much a segregated society, a segregated culture, but there's so much paradox about all of that, too. You know, at the same mm-hmm. time, at the same time, I talk about how wonderful the South is.
Right.
And how much warmth there is, and how people pride themselves on hospitality. And although, you know, in Mississippi there's this history of, you know, such brutal racism. On the other side of that, there's also this great kindness that you can witness as well between the races. You know, there's a great understanding, and it's really difficult to explain. You have to be in it to get an appreciation of it.
Hot your mama's in the red eye, yes, got a tail. He got 2 for a nickel, got 4 for a dime. Well, I would sell you more, but there ain't none of mine. Hot your mama's in the red eye, yes, got a tail. Yes, got a tail. Good.
Cassandra Wilson singing her version of Hot Tamales from her album Belly of the Sun. She spoke with us in 2002.
Hot tamales in the red eye, yes, got them to sell. Hot tamales in the red eye, yes, got them to sell. Sweet diddly love the bell, all the day, bop the bop, 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 bop. Hot tamales in the red eye, yes, got them to sell, oh yeah. Yes, got to sail. Hot tamales in the red hot. Yes, got to sail. Hot tamales in the red hot. Yes, got to sail. Got red sail. Long, tall sleeves in the kitchen with the feet in the hollow. Hot tamales in the red hot. Yes, got to sail. Yes, yes, got to sail. Oh, yeah. Yes, got to sail.
Laura Cantrell has the soul of an austere mid-century Appalachian singer, but the resume of a high-flying Wall Street wizard. Born in Nashville, Ivy League educated, she wore a business suit by day and sang a raftful of sweet old-school country songs at night. It's a combination worthy of one of her biggest fans, Elvis Costello. In fact, Cantrell's country music career first took off in the UK. Laura Cantrell brought her story, her songs, and her guitar to On Point last year. I asked her how the likes of Elvis Costello and the famed British DJ John Peel, who said her first album was his favorite record of the last 10 years, first found her music.
Well, you know, it's still sort of mind-blowing to me, but I was basically an artist doing country music who couldn't really get arrested in the United States. So I had the good fortune to have an independent label in the UK, the Glasgow-based Shoeshine Records, that wanted to put out my music.
And this is still when you're a vice president at Bank of America Securities, business manager of equity research.
Yes, yes, I was.
With a label in Glasgow. It's pretty good.
I know, it's really the most unlikely set of different circumstances you could cram into one story, I think. But that opportunity to release the music there really gave me a chance to kind of take a serious look at what I was doing and how much I wanted to get to travel and perform. And also, it brought the music to the BBC and to John Peel and to the record shops of the UK, which is where Elvis found it. So, you know, it's really something I hadn't really envisioned for myself, but by sort of happy accident, here we are. So,
well, the reviews are in, and they're great. Everybody, you know, this voice that's precious and businesslike, they're still playing with you on your business past, I think, the USA Today. New York Times is wise, sweetly troubled. Let's get something, just to give a sense of that range, two lawyers for parents and growing up in West Nashville suburbs, off to New York and then back to country. What was that about, Laura Cantrell? Did you get homesick and decided you need to have some country in your New York apartment?
To kind of simplify the story, yes, you could say that in a way. I had the experience that a lot of folks who travel from the South and sort of identify themselves as Southern do when they leave that sort of Southern culture behind them, which is kind of what it felt like when I came to go to school in New York City. It was a way for me to connect with what I felt like was the culture of my family and kind of with the history of the place. It's, you know, it's a kind of a interesting, troubled history. So, you know, it's to sort of understand it through the music was something that seemed interesting when I was a college kid, just starting to listen to Hank Williams records and the Carter family and what have you, and I kind of got hooked.
It's funny how that happens. I read that in your household growing up, this was not the music of the house. Your parents had more serious, I shouldn't say more serious, but they had different musical tastes. But as somebody who came from mid-America farmland to the city myself, I know that funny feeling where you're reaching not just for the music of your parents, but for the music of a region to kind of touch base with it again. It made me want
Absolutely.
To ask you, if country music, given your path, is it the birthright of all Americans, of any American? Do you have to earn the right to sing country music?
Well, I think that I can get as agitated as any other naysayer about some of the modern country music and how it kind of uses what I think are sort of stereotypes of rural life to basically find its own demographic. And that is something that I think is kind of fake.
Playing the market.
Yeah, I think that bugs me when I see that happen. At the same time, I think country music is a very directly expressive, emotional kind of music. And it is a sort of form of soul music. And I think anybody that can communicate that way has the right to sing it or can get its message from it. So, you know, that was one thing that was very interesting to me coming to New York City.
Mm-hmm.
I was at Columbia in the 80s and did college radio there. And through the fans of the campus radio station, I found that there were many generations of country music fans who'd, you know, lived in Queens and heard their first country music when they went off to Southern Army camps as they were getting shipped out to World War II or whatever.
Right.
You know, there's millions of ways that people first sort of discover or become aware of country music. And there were a lot of those folks in New York City, and they had nothing to do with having grown up in this authentic rural setting. So it kind of widened my own view of what a country music fan could be.
Laura Cantrill, how do you describe the difference between what you do and where mainstream country music is these days?
Well, I think, you know, I'm trying to do something that's pretty simple, and I think of it as simple and direct, and kind of hearkening back to the kind of older styles of country music. But at the same time, I'm not trying to just recreate a style for the sake of a style, and I'm trying to, in my own kind of fumbling way, find a way to sort of express, you know, express the point of view of a young person living in this time, but through this type of music.
I'd say, I know you've got your guitar there in the studio in New York. We want to hear a song as we head into a break here from your latest album, When the Roses Bloom Again. It's called Mountain Fern. You wrote it. Tell us the story of this song.
This song was written sort of in tribute to one of the great lady singers. Her name's Molly O'Day, and she left the music business before she was as famous as she would have been because she was a wonderful artist.
1940s singer.
Yes, she was a singer in the late 40s. But she left the business because of her very strong fundamentalist Christian religious beliefs. So I just always thought she was an interesting person. And
you've heard from her family since it came out.
Actually, I did. I had the pleasure and an honor, because you never know when you're writing about someone who has a real history what they would think of it or what their family would think of it. Molly O'Day's been dead since the 70s, but her family got in touch with me and said how much they appreciated the song. So it was really validating to have that appreciation kind of communicated back to me
through the
modern marvel of the internet.
Let's hear it. This is Mountain Fern from When the Roses Bloom Again, Laura Cantrill.
Left her home on the mountain as a young girl, and she traveled and rambled all through the wide world. And the world was Kentucky, and then Tennessee, West Virginia to Texas, and everything in between. And her name would be different from place to place, and her heart might get heavy sometime, with a worn prayer book in a guitar case, in a boarding house room, her banjo she plays, and the
Laura Cantrill singing Mountain Fern from her album When the Roses Bloom Again. She spoke with us last year. For more on her latest album, Humming by the Flowered Vine, go to our website, onpointradio.org. There's much more to come in this special edition of On Point after the break. Michelle Schacht and Katie Lang. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Well, the road, it got dusty, hot, long, and hard. Traveling night, noon, and morning in an old Packard car. And though she found fame and fortune on the radio way, well, it never came easy, and she
to be safe.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight we're bringing you a special edition of On Point, listening back to some of our favorite musicians who've stopped by the studio. Tomorrow night we'll hear from the guys. Tonight we've tuned in to the voices of women whose music we've loved. At the height of the MTV 80s, Michelle Schacht went off the rails of the pop music mainstream with her roots-rocking album Short, Sharp, Schacht. She defied record label disapproval and kept rolling. She fought for creative freedom and ownership of her inimitable songs. It took 10 years, but Michelle Schacht won. She started up her own label, Mighty Sound Records, and she never looked back. We caught up with her in 2003 after the re-release of Short, Sharp, Schacht. I asked her why she decided to bring the album out again.
Well, here's the way I want to tell this story, and since you're asking me, I had negotiated a very extraordinary deal as a young artist where I turned down the money. I said, keep the money. I don't want your money. I want the rights. I want the ownership. And about halfway into the contract, they came to me and said, you cut too good a deal for yourself, young lady, and we want those rights back. And if you don't, and the consequences were kind of unspoken, but they were, in fact, what took place was for the next 5 years, I was in this wilderness kind of wandering through the legal charts and channels of the American landscape. And so I finally defended those rights. But, you know, it's funny, the way I want to explain this, and I don't know if it's really gotten understood well, is I had a choice. I could have just gone with the program. I could have given them the rights back and kind of kept their monopoly on artists' catalog intact. But I had broken away from the pact as a young artist, and I made a stand on principle to fight for those rights that I had won for myself. And yeah, it cost me 5 years of my career. But the good news is, here I am 15 years later in a very good position to reissue my masters, have them all in print under my own Mighty Sound label, and with all the creative direction and packaging that I choose. So it's a lot of power, and I think there's a point or a moral in there for young artists somewhere.
Hang with it. I mean, them trying to get Michelle Schacht to go with the program, talk about a hopeless cause. I mean, if anybody won't go with the program, I guess it's you. And as you pull some back out of that songbook, and I hope you'll be thinking, you've got your guitar there about playing Memories of East Texas for us, but can you still... in 2003, inhabit these songs the way you did in 1987, 1988?
Of course. I mean, these were written as timeless classics. I'm sorry to be quite so confident about the quality of the work, but the musical values that are in them are timeless. Details about the place that you're speaking from. You've got to come from a place as a writer, and that's what these songs do.
Before you give us Memories of East Texas, set it up just a little bit for us, your childhood there.
Well, my stepfather was in the Army, and I'd spend the summers with my father, but my mother lived way back in East Texas. Gilmer is called the town. Well, really, Kelsey is the town next to Gilmer, but Kelsey's so small, nobody, you can't even find it on the map. Gilmer is right between Shreveport and Dallas, so people can find it if they look. And I had been, unlike most of the people there, I'd been out of the county in my lifetime. And I just never really fit in. When I moved there at 15, I was already, you know, an outsider and never really destined to fit in. But this particular song, I think, characterizes something a lot of people can relate to. If you can think back to the first time you drove a car.
Let's hear it. Memories of East Texas, Michelle Schacht.
Memories of East Texas, in pine and green rolling hills, covered in the springtime with golden daffodils. Rowing on Sandy Lake come April, harvesting hay in June. Sitting by the road watching wildfires burn by an old October moon. I learned to drive on those East Texas red clay back roads. And I mean to tell you, my friends, they weren't no easy roads. You had to watch out for all the curves down by Kelsey Creek, and detour through the Lindsay's pasture and the water ran too deep. Memories of East Texas and Gilmer County, seat of Upshur. Looking back and asking myself, what the hell did you let him break your spirit for, girl? You know, their lives ran in circles so small, they thought they'd seen it all. And they could not make a place for a girl who'd seen the ocean. I learned to drive on those East Texas red clay back roads. And I mean to tell you, my friends, they weren't no easy roads. No, no, you had to watch out for all the curves down by Kelsey Creek. And detour through the Lindsay's pasture when the water ran too deep. Of East Texas and those piney green rolling hills covered in the springtime with those wild daffodils, and sitting in those piney woods and playing my guitar, thinking back on the roads I'd come, thinking I had not come that far. I learned to drive on those East Texas red clay back roads. And I mean to tell you, my friends, no, they weren't no easy roads. You had to watch out for all the curves down by Kelsey Creek. Detour through the Lindsay's pasture when the water ran too deep.
Michelle Schacht. Yeah, I guess you still inhabit that song pretty well, Michelle.
That's what I'm saying. You know, I haven't been back there in, what, 25 years?
Wow.
But it's not about being there. It's about remembering that place.
It sure is. You know this line, the detour through Lindsay's pasture, as a bona fide one-time farm kid myself, that I see that so clearly. You know, there's
all
something
right
across the road, and you just detour where you detour.
Come on, Tom. I know your listeners would like to hear about your first time.
No.
It was a tractor, wasn't it? It was a tractor. Admit it.
No,
it's a,
well,
you were
sure,
12.
But that didn't count. It wasn't until you got the pickup truck, right?
Uh-huh.
But the Michelle Schacht story really lives, it seems to me, in this line, looking back and asking myself, what the hell did you let them break your spirit for? What's the breaking the spirit? You ran away, or left home anyway, in 1977. You were 16. Why did you leave? What was sending you packing?
I say it like this now, that I was following my instincts. And because of the path that my life has taken from following those instincts, I've come up with a pretty pithy little summary of my philosophy about instincts, if you'd like to hear it.
Yeah.
I say, you know, instincts are a gift. We all receive instincts when we're young, when we need them the most. We receive these instincts. But a lot of times the courage to follow our instincts, we sometimes mistakenly refer to as talent. It's like the country boys. He was heading off for the big city. And remember that movie Hair? And his dad says, son, God takes care of the fools. It's the clever ones that have to look after themselves.
Michelle Schacht spoke with On Point in 2003. Coming up, K.D. Lang, but first, here's a little from Michelle Schacht's latest album, Mexican Standoff.
Talking about the weasel.
Over 40 years ago, legendary country singer Patsy Cline died in a plane crash at the tender age of 30. 2 decades later, a young K.D. Lang came out with her first album. Her group back then was called K.D. Lang and the Reclines, and the Cline in Reclines was all Patsy. From the beginning, K.D. Lang has built a remarkable career on the explicit foundation of endless homage to Patsy Cline. In 2003, she was one of the marquee names on a Patsy Cline tribute album. Norah Jones was there, Diana Krall, Amy Grant, and many others. When we caught up with her, I asked K.D. Lang to do a little reminiscing and take us back to her college days when she was first taken with Patsy Cline.
I was a performance artist. I was doing industrial punk music in Edmonton, Alberta.
Okay.
And I came out of college studying music, and when I got asked to do a musical theater piece, mm-hmm. I guess I was around the age of 21.
Yeah.
And also on my 21st birthday, I got 2 Patsy Cline records. So these 2 things happened simultaneously that sort of caused an explosion of sorts in terms of my inspiration. And the part that I played in the musical theater piece mm-hmm. was fashioned after Patsy Cline. So then I started to listen to the music and study it. And this, like I said, this is coming from industrial punk and performance art. So
right.
I was coming from it from maybe a different door. I say I came sort of to country music through the back door kind of thing.
And yet you grew up in Alberta, so the kind of country twang was not exactly unfamiliar to you. Couldn't have been.
No, it was completely ingrained in my person, but it wasn't something that I necessarily appreciated.
Right.
And it was something that I saw as a limitation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny because when I actually found country music through Patsy Cline at the time of being a punk artist and a performance artist, that I really actually found that to be kind of limiting. There's no tradition in it, so...
You mean suddenly the industrial performance art didn't seem to have the roots you needed?
Right. Mm. I needed something to play off of. So country music and Patsy Cline was something that just really intrigued me because of sort of the mindset of country music and the political, I guess, tradition of country music and it being sort of Christian and male and
right.
kind of a more conservative mindset that I found it infinitely interesting and full of potential for me to come in and as a Canadian Buddhist lesbian vegetarian.
Hello.
Yeah. That there was kind of a lot of potential there. So.
So off you went.
Off I went, but really through the vehicle of Patsy Cline and through the vehicle of her voice.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about that because you may have got those 2 records when you were 21 years old, but you had to have grown up with Patsy Cline in the air. I mean, you couldn't avoid it. You still can't avoid it in the United States or Canada, for that matter. Had you always heard it, and was it just background music? And what was the depth charge that went off when you sat with these 2 albums at 21?
I hadn't really heard it. The only time I remember hearing it was on a KTEL ad on TV. Because
okay.
We had two radio stations. We had 1 television station.
Mm.
And the 1 radio station was country, and I didn't listen to that.
And not a media-rich environment then.
No, not. So I didn't really hear Patsy Cline until, I guess what happened was my older siblings fell in love with the movie Coal Miner's Daughter, and mm-hmm. they were like, oh, you've got to check out Patsy Cline. And I guess I had basically heard Patsy Cline through people like Linda Ronstadt and Emmylou Harris because I was listening to them
right.
at an early age.
Right.
So when I got those 2 records, I heard something in it that I don't know what happened. It really was like a spontaneous combustion. All of a sudden I had this visualization of how I could do country and how I could look, how I could feel, and how I could mix all these great different genres into 1, rockabilly, jazz, country, rock, and bluegrass, and even, you know, the torch singing, all into 1, because that's what I heard when I hear Patsy Cline.
But I wonder how you, as you say, I forget the whole line, but Buddhist, lesbian, anti-meat eating, and all the rest, very modern, contemporary woman, without any of the burdens or constraints of a Southern housewife, what exactly was your path in? Was it camp, Or was it some genuine connection? It clearly has evolved into a very genuine connection.
Both. Definitely both. To me, I that's what I appreciate about Patsy Cline. To me, something has to have a sense of humor in order to be real.
Yeah.
Because I think that life itself is in equal parts irony, humor, sadness, happiness, beauty, ugliness.
Is
I think
ever,
that
yeah.
you can't separate that. And to me, you know, Patsy Cline had all of those things, especially in her voice. You know, there was truth in her voice, and all those things were contained.
Got leaving on your mind. Tell me now, get it over. Hurt me now, get it over.
Katie Lang singing the Patsy Cline classic Leavin' on Your Mind. Katie Lang joined us at On Point in 2003. For more information on all of the wonderful women you've heard tonight, visit our website at onpointradio.org. Coming up tomorrow in part two of this special On Point Summer Series, we'll hear from some of America's greatest rock and roll legends, including Ry Cooter, John Mellencamp, Lou Reed, and Wilco. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.